1995 Sandstone Symposium presents session number 125, Nauru and Mormon History, at the Crossroads of Faith and History, by Roger D. Lanius.
It's a real pleasure and a privilege for me to introduce to you our speaker this morning, who is going to assess recent developments in the history of Mormon Nauvoo, particularly as it relates to the conflict in Western Illinois in the mid-1840s. Dr. Lanius is the chief historian for the National Aeronautics and Space Administration, more commonly known as NASA. What he really does is spend his time making movies like Apollo 13, but that will be another Sunstone topic someday to hear him tell us about that. Dr. Lanius was born in Galesburg, Illinois, grew up in Greenville, South Carolina. He graduated from Graceland College in Lamoni, Iowa, with a major in history, and he received his MA and both MA and PhD degrees in history at Louisiana State University, with major fields in American frontier and military history. Rogers had an interesting combination of Western history, the military, aerospace. And you kind of get the feeling that he's an adventuresome sort of guy. After completing his PhD, Dr. Lanius became a staff historian with the essentially in the Air Force, and he served at a number of different locations, including Scott Air Force Base in Illinois, Hill Air Force Base here in Utah, Andrews Air Force Base in Maryland, and then most recently in Washington, D.C., where he is now, as I said, with NASA. He has been an adjunct professor of history for McKendree College in Lebanon, Illinois, as well as Weber State College here in Utah. Roger is probably the one of the most prolific of the writers in Mormon history from the RLDS branch of the Restoration tradition, and many of you will be familiar with his works. If you look in your program at, in addition to this session, which is number 125, session 141 is a book signing where Roger will be available, and in your program for session 141 is a list of several of his books relating to Mormon history. He has also published in the area of aerospace history and other subjects. He is a recent past president of the Mormon History Association. His book, Joseph Smith III, Pragmatic Prophet, which was published by the University of Illinois in 1988, won the prestigious Evans Award for biography. And he's presently conducting research for a book-length history of aviation in the American West. Again, that interesting combination. He has a lighter side. I'm told that in Kingston this summer at MHA meetings, he was found in the bookstore reveling in Dave Barry's book, A Guide to Guys, really enjoying that. Dr. Lanius is married to Vianne Tiffany, formerly of Grand Junction, Colorado. They have two children, Dana and Sarah. I will turn the time over to Roger. He will go for 40 minutes or so, and then we will open it to questions from you. Roger.
Well, good morning, everybody. It's a pleasure to be here. Can everybody hear me? I'm going to kind of put this to the side a little bit. I've never had too much trouble projecting. I have to, my publisher demanded that, and I would do it anyway, to make an unadulterated plug for the new book. It's called Cultures in Conflict. It's a documentary history of the Mormon War in Illinois. John Hallwas, who is a professor of English, actually, at Western Illinois University in Macomb, and I put this together over the last couple, 3 years. It's an interesting set of documents. Well, we think it's interesting anyway. Set of documents about the conflict, some written by Mormons, some written by non-Mormons, some written by anti-Mormons, that I think do quite a lot to help to explain the subject area, and we try to illuminate that. And this is kind of going to be the subject of my discussion today. And getting to the question of the crossroads of faith and history, I would contend that Nauvoo, Illinois, located on the bend of the Mississippi River in Hancock County, most of you probably been there at some time or another, a beautiful setting. Wonderful park-like place today. It's just as much a state of mind as it is a physical place. It's today a small community of less than 1,500 residents without access to major highways, railroads, or airports. Nauvoo appears peaceful, park-like, very sedate and serene. You can hear the cicadas in the evening. You can go down and sit by the river and watch the boats go by in the quiet of the evening. Now, part of the town is devoted to an idealized reconstruction of the Mormon city of the 1840s, and it draws visitors from around the world. To the thousands of Mormons who come to Nauvoo each year, it's much more than just a pleasant setting or an American historic site. Somebody suggested that at one time it was wanted in the saints. It represents a seedbed from which spring many important doctrinal concepts, a place where the religion in a really fundamental way took shape. Considered from that perspective, the rise and fall of Mormon Nauvoo is a sacred episode, a refiner's fire in which pioneers of the church encountered opposition and demonstrated their spiritual superiority. In the 1840s, they met an opposition that led to casualties on all sides. One of those casualties was Joseph Smith, Jr., the Mormon prophet who was lynched in nearby Carthage while awaiting trial in 1844 for crimes both real and imagined. The scars of that struggle are still present in the attitudes and perspectives of present-day Mormonism, of both the LDS and the RLDS varieties, I would add. Hence, the town's early history is regarded as a kind of verification of religious truth, and Nauvoo is central to, I think, the Mormon identity. While headquartered in Nauvoo, Joseph Smith expressed many innovative theological ideas, some of which revolved around rituals to be conducted in a majestic temple built in the city. Excavation for the foundation of this temple began, as you know, in the fall of 1840, but the real impetus to build it took place on January 19th of 1841, when Smith proclaimed a revelation commanding the building's aggressive construction. Thereafter, work on the building continued for zest for about 5 years. Even more important than that particular level of activity, it dominated the lives of the people who lived there. It dominated it both economically, but also spiritually. I would contend that temple building in Nauvoo terrified the non-Mormons. It cost a huge amount of money, something in the neighborhood of $1 million. But the demands of the temple construction, as well as the other building that was taking place in Nauvoo, strained the resources of Mormons almost to the breaking point, yet they didn't really complain. In relentlessly pursuing the objectives, the Mormons sent an ominous signal about priorities and loyalties to other residents in western Illinois. It revealed something of the numerical and economic strength of the community, and it also symbolized the religious, especially the theocratic, tendencies of the saints. They were willing to sacrifice literally everything they had to accomplish the work that had been defined by the institutional leader. The building, which was never completed, as we know, before Joseph Smith's death, was first used for meetings in October of 1845, and only for a very short period of time did anyone undertake religious activities there, and in 1846 it was essentially abandoned. That sent also signals to the non-Mormons of the community. There's no secrets in history. You all know that the building was gutted by a fire in 1848 set by an arsonist named Joseph Agnew and knocked down by a tornado in 1850 that knocked that sucker flat and end of the Nauvoo Temple. The temple for the saints was a symbol of the theological ferment present in Joseph Smith and expressed there in Nauvoo. And for inheritors of the mainline Joseph Smith legacy, Nauvoo, I think, was the first major explication of their vision of the world. And they historically and presently tend to see this significance first when looking at the community. Ronald Esplin, in an insightful article published in 1990, said, and I quote, "Nauvoo was and is and will remain important to Latter-day Saints because it was the city of Joseph. It was a city where he built, where he lived and acted, where he died. Above all, it was the city where he fulfilled his religious mission." I think that gets to the heart of the temple. This attitude has shaped the direction of historical studies about Nauvoo from the very beginning. And most historians who share the Latter-day Saint faith have accepted a sort of institutional morality play about Nauvoo. Ever since the 1840s, Mormons have viewed Nauvoo as a pivotal episode, something that is important to the development of the religion, to its growth, to its organization, and especially to its doctrines. As one of the best general histories of Mormonism indicates, and I quote for you, at Nauvoo, Joseph Smith reached the zenith of both his temporal and spiritual influence as a secular mayor of one of the two largest cities of Illinois, editor of its newspaper, a leading entrepreneur, and a candidate for the presidency of the United States. As a spiritual leader, he announced important new doctrinal ideas, began the erection of a magnificent temple, introduced a sacred temple ceremony that helped increase brotherhood and spirituality among the saints, and laid the foundation for expanding the kingdom worldwide. His tragic martyrdom in 1844 became a rallying point for a greater spirituality among the saints and strengthened the kingdom instead of destroying it, as his antagonists had hoped. And in this process, Joseph Smith is not regarded as a martyr to theocracy, which is what I would contend was really the case, but as a martyr to the divine mission of the church, and even ironically, as a martyr to freedom of religion. Nauvoo was the sacred context of that martyrdom. Much of the scholarship that deals with Mormon Nauvoo is essentially sacred history, and it has to be because of what I just said about the temple. It too often, however, reduces the complexity of events, avoids matters that challenge or contradict Mormon myth, views the Mormons as good and their opponents as evil, and ignores the cultural context of the early church. Unfortunately, as an explanation for these kinds of past events, such analyses have serious limitations. Bob Flanders, some of you probably know Bob, others of you have probably read his book about Nauvoo, made a comment in 1973 that I think is very illuminating. He said, "Utah began in Nauvoo, as did the dissenting sects of Mormonism, such as the Reorganized Church, but in a different way." He added that, and I'll quote for you, "Nauvoo was a volatile mixture of elements, American patriotism, immigrant dreams of the promised land, displaced person desperation, religious mysticism and fanaticism, free experimentation with new social, ethical, and politico-economic modes, optimism, opportunism, energy, and escalating violence within and without." Whether those lessons be positive or negative, and I think that we all decide up on that, that doesn't really matter. The compelling factor in all of this is that the experience is central to our identity, and we have to deal with it in that context. In terms of the RLDS, which is what I'm most familiar with, Bob Flanders was right on when he talked about Nauvoo. But in our case, we have a different perspective. It's not the place where Joseph Smith lived and died and brought to fruition his full mission. It is, at best, a failed experiment. We have admired the period as a time in which the secular nature of the Zionic enterprise reigned supreme. It was both a triumph and a tragedy in that sense, the lessons that the RLDS have taken to heart ever since 1844. We have been, and we continue to be attracted to the success and the image of the city. It was the closest approximation the church had to the ideals of Zion carried on in Scripture and doctrine. The political power and the secular authority also served the RLDS membership as reminders of the ultimate goal of the church, the merging of church and state into a benevolent theocratic democracy that we call Zion. At the same time, the reorganization has been, continues to be, and I think always will be, repelled by what we consider the darker sides of political power: corruption, influence peddling, and the hardness of political choices. Much the same was true when considering the other aspects of the Nauvoo experience in such realms as the development of theology, the growth and development of church institutions and ecclesiastical quorums, the treatment of some individuals toward others, both in terms of group loyalty and dissident elements, and the promotion of peace versus a warrior mentality. Each of the reactions contributed toward the formation of a movement that in essence rejected what its members have usually considered the excesses of Nauvoo. And those excesses really revolve around political, theological, and social issues. And the RLDS Church has moved consciously in opposition to those. Well, all of this is simply to say that, and perhaps an overstatement of the obvious, that Nauvoo stands at the crossroads of faith and history. It is central to our consideration of who we are. And it represents a variety of things that I've talked about before. Both the RLDS and the LDS have had tremendous difficulty when confronted with the perception of Nauvoo that is less favorable to the saints and their practices in Illinois than we would like to think. The RLDS have had to deal with such things as polygamy. We've spent 100 years denying that it ever happened. That's not rational, we just did it. And it was enormously difficult to come to grips with that. We finally started to do so, although as little as about 3 or 4 years ago, I have been accosted by people who said, how can you say that Joseph Smith was a prophet and yet say that he practiced polygamy? And I said, I didn't know the two were mutually exclusive. But anyway, it is for the RLDS. Essentially, there is an assumption that reigns in Nauvoo, that reigns among people who study Nauvoo, who have their inheritance in the early movement, that the Mormons have been and always were in that particular era victims of persecution, and that they were totally innocent. That's myth. It has been prevalent everywhere, and we document it in great detail, ad nauseum, and probably with a great deal of overkill in this little book. There doesn't seem to be a lot of religious persecution that took place in Nauvoo. Oh, I know you weren't taught that in Sunday school. Neither was I. What actually was happening there was that non-Mormons saw a theocracy and reacted against that. One of the most cherished principles of the United States, and certainly it was present in emergent Jacksonian democracy, is the separation of church and state. I mean, we have been down the road with this, and we fight battles right up to the present over things like this, and it revolves around issues like school prayer and a variety of other things that are very hotly contested even today. What they saw in Nauvoo was a theocracy run by Joseph Smith, by Joseph Smith, and on behalf of the saints. In 1841, a non-Mormon group met in nearby Carthage and passed a resolution. It said, and I quote for you, "With the peculiar religious opinions of the people calling themselves Mormons, or Latter-day Saints, we have nothing to do, being at all times perfectly willing that they shall remain in the full possession of the rights and privileges which our Constitution and laws guarantee. But in standing up as we do to oppose the influence which these people have obtained and are likely to obtain in a political capacity over our fellow citizens and their liberties, we are guided by a desire to defend ourselves against despotism, the extent and consequences of which we have no means of ascertaining." That's the end of the quote. Indeed, the local non-Mormons realized that Joseph Smith sought to establish control over very nearly every arena of his followers' activity. They expressed specific concerns that grated on the Republican ideals of the region, especially the general control of Nauvoo's civil affairs by a church, violating as it does the separation of church and state. One non-Mormon from Alton wrote in the Telegraph, the local newspaper there, quote, "Their religious and political creeds are identical and as directly at variance with the spirit of our institutions as any system that man could possibly devise. At Nauvoo, social and political order ultimately rested on divine order, which was an old world idea that had led to the establishment of state religions in Europe and ultimately, we don't like to admit this, to the rise of organized religious persecution there." Marvin Hill has argued persuasively, I think, that these efforts on the part of the Mormons in Nauvoo should be viewed as an attempt to escape from the evils of American pluralism and secularism, and the erection of a strong theocratic organization in Nauvoo would counter external pressures that they felt that they were seeing in the United States. This resulted in a far-ranging political conflict that began soon after the Saints arrived in Illinois and lasted until they had largely removed in 1846. It was always ideologically motivated, and the tragic conflict was violent in many occasions. It led to the deaths of Joseph and Hiram Smith, the murders of several other lesser figures on both sides, numerous raids of property and persons, and at least one full-fledged battle in September of 1846, the so-called Battle of Nauvoo. It only ended when Brigham Young removed the majority of the Mormons outside of Illinois and headed west on the Great Trek. From the very earliest history of the Latter-day Saint movement, the sense that Joseph Smith and his followers were being unjustly persecuted by sinister groups conspiring to destroy the gospel was a persistent theme. Smith was convinced that as soon as his religious career began, enemies of the gospel were everywhere present and sought to bring the downfall of both himself and the church. Smith couched these ideas about persecution of the innocent. He was always innocent, in the context of an overarching, well-organized, and sinister conspiracy. Americans love conspiracy theories, the Kennedy assassination, Vincent Foster suicide, you know, any number of things. They're all conspiracies. And if you don't believe it's a conspiracy, then obviously you're a member of the conspiracy. So, there's nothing new here. I've got a couple of quotes that I'll pass over from Joseph Smith that kind of demonstrates what I'm going to say. But I don't believe that there was religious persecution, and I don't think that the Mormons were persecuted innocents, as Joseph Smith suggested. I would suggest, however, that this misapprehension about religious persecution at Nauvoo arose for a variety of reasons. And the major one was because there was no separation between the government and the church at Nauvoo. And non-Mormon opposition to Mormon theocratic behavior was regarded by Joseph Smith and his associates as religious persecution. I don't believe it was. Indeed, because he was a religious leader, Smith commonly characterized any criticism of him, for whatever reason, by non-Mormons or by disaffected Mormons as religious persecution of a holy, innocent man. The myth of persecuted innocence was an overwhelmingly important aspect of the Mormon experience. It was a myth that allowed the Mormons to maintain their cohesiveness, but that's about the extent of it. The myth of innocence, which is ubiquitous in Mormon documents of the Nauvoo period, reveals that the retreat from American religious pluralism to the theocratic separatist community of Nauvoo represented an escape from moral ambiguity, from the fear of making the wrong choices. As a religious city-state under tight control, Nauvoo was a haven where the followers of Joseph Smith had their most important choices. What they would do to serve God made for them, their innocence, that is, and thereby their infallibility, was thus guaranteed. And their place as God's chosen people was exaggerated. As is common in such situations, the threat of evil was projected onto others, in this case, the Gentiles or dissident Mormons, who were regarded as ungodly enemies. Another way of saying the same thing is that a chosen people always define themselves against an unchosen opposite. And through that mythic dichotomy, differences in human culture, beliefs, and values are transmuted into differences in human nature, the good versus the evil. Hence at Nauvoo, the innocent children of God realized their identity through their struggle against the evil followers of Satan, who dominated American society everywhere else except in the city of the saints. The problem, of course, with this kind of dichotomous myth is that for the people who hold it, guilt and innocence are matters of belief, not of evidence. Thus at Nauvoo, Joseph Smith could engage in secret polygamy, lie to his followers about it, as he did. And when accusations were made against him, he could go into a public meeting, denounce his accusers, and be regarded by his followers as a persecuted innocent victim. He could repress the civil rights of his critics, as he did. He could deny them due process of law, as he did. He could deny them freedom of the press, as he did. All of these instances in the Expositor Affair. And could be celebrated by his followers as champions of righteousness as a result, because he was protecting the innocent community of believers. Conversely, men of integrity who criticized the prophet, such as William Law, could be defamed as enemies of the people and instantly regarded as opponents who were totally evil. William Law, you probably know, was a member of the First Presidency of the Church up until the spring of 1844. He was one of the most trusted members of Joseph Smith's inner circle for a time. Willard Richards writes of him, just after he broke with the church, that William Law and his associates are thieves, counterfeiters, bogus makers, gamblers, debauchers, murderers, and all that is vile. How did this happen? In the space of, you know, like 10 minutes. Dissenters, by their very act of expressing dissent, were cast out of the ranks of the inherently innocent and transmuted, and into the inherently evil. Always dissenters were characterized as misbegotten, woeful malcontents whose arguments were without foundation. The problem was with the dissenters' characters, not with the church or its leadership. Often the personal sins of dissenters were trotted out for public display, and if there were none immediately at hand, they were trumped up, and I think they were in the case of William Law. Crimes both real and imagined were described in a depth not seen except in the most vicious political campaigns. Dissenters, because of their supposed flaws, were threats to the integrity of the gospel and were deserving of expulsion. Not just expulsion from the church, but expulsion from the community. The institution was always judged to be sound. The dissenters themselves were defective. That mythic shift, the transmutation of the dissenters from innocent to evil, justified any and all acts of aggression on the part of the church against those dissenters, including destroying the Nauvoo Expositor, press, and building, setting fire to others of the dissenters' buildings, threatening their lives and forcing them to flee from their homes into the Iowa Territory. The tragic irony of all of this is that the myth of innocence prevented the Mormons of Nauvoo from learning anything from their own violent expulsion from Missouri and about the need to respect the rights of others. So they reacted to it, with themselves in the role of the aggressors. As one might suspect, this mythic mindset led to intimidation and vilification of nonconformists. It also helped to foster a counter-myth on the part of the non-Mormons, who viewed the troublesome religious separatists of Nauvoo as wicked and themselves as the virtuous champions of Americans' cherished ideology, democracy. But unlike the Mormons, the non-Mormons felt increasingly overwhelmed by their mythic opposites, who had taken control by 1843 of the county. And in short, myth begat myth, and the result was ultimately bloodshed. A good illustration of how the myth in Mormon documents reshapes and interprets events is the following paragraph I want to read to you from the journal of Joseph Grafton Hovey, a young Mormon who was living in Nauvoo at the time. He wrote it in 1842. He says, "About this time there came among us one John C. Bennett." Everybody heard of him? "With great recommend..." By the way, there's a biography on its way out the door that is going to totally reinterpret Mr. Bennett. You will find it very interesting. I didn't write it, but a fellow by the name of Andrew Smith did. It will be out next year. Therefore, John C. Bennett was put in the office of the Major General of the Nauvoo Legion. All things were in a prosperous condition until 1842, when the aforesaid Bennett, Chauncey Higbee, and others did go about our city insulting our wives and our daughters, telling them that it was right to have free intercourse with the fair sex. They said that the prophet Joseph taught that it was the word of the Lord. Therefore, many were deceived. Hence he, that is Bennett, had a good opportunity to practice his fiendish designs. He was a man of great talent, according to the Gentiles. However, he was brought before the authorities and cut off from the church. He then went into the cities and states and tried to bring persecution upon us by telling that we believed in more than one wife and having all things in common. In fact, everything the devil could do to destroy our prophet Joseph. The newspapers were filled with the most vile and audacious calumnies that could be invented by the enemies of all good. This account by a Nauvoo resident views Bennett as a follower of the devil, one of the enemies of all good, who was out to destroy the prophet and the church. Therefore, it was the fiendish Bennett who originated polygamy, which Hovey denigrates as the, quote, right to have free intercourse. And the prophet, of course, had nothing to do with that. Yeah, right. Hovey also says in his next paragraph that Joseph Smith was innocent of everything, as innocent as the angels of heaven. Bennett was, in fact, made the scapegoat, I think, for actions that the Nauvoo Mormons did not want to acknowledge in Smith or in the Mormon community as a whole. However, there is, as we all know, conclusive evidence that Joseph Smith originated and engaged in polygamy, which was upsetting to Hovey and to others, including those RLDS people, by the way, who spent, as I said, 100 years denouncing that it ever happened. But the myth of persecuted innocence made it impossible for this Mormon to embrace any alternative position, and Hovey, I think, was typical. What I'm saying here suggests that the Mormon mythic consciousness not only substantially conditioned what took place in Nauvoo, but also later shaped the church's historical comprehension of what has occurred. Mormon scholars have tended to dismiss all critical non-Mormon documents as ill-motivated and therefore untrustworthy, while regarding documents by the saints as of basically reliable nature, both for factual reconstruction and for interpretation. Through that practice, Mormon myth embodied in the documents has gone unrecognized and in some instances has been used to substantiate a sacred story. The lessons of the Nauvoo experience need to be understood, I think, by modern LDS leaders as they express their own mythical version of theocratic government, demonization of other people, and believing in the illusion of innocence. More important, perhaps, the lessons of the Nauvoo era have a tremendous applicability to understanding cultural conflict in a much broader scale than just among the Mormons. Conflict promoted by black and white mindsets, which I think is what took place in Nauvoo, are present throughout the United States at this present day. The nation's militia movement, the religious right, racist rhetoricians, ideologues of all stripes, apocalyptic groups, and the like all exhibit similar characteristics to the contending factions in Nauvoo in the 1840s. They, like the groups associated with Nauvoo, display a confusion of their personal and organizational goals with the overarching common good and provide the easy justification for a mob mentality and extra-legal violence. We saw that not very long ago in Oklahoma City. They, like the contending groups surrounding Nauvoo in the 1840s, have developed powerful rationales for their actions based on these dichotomous myths. America, I think, is rapidly degenerating toward contention based on competing worldviews, on competing cultures. Some groups, such as the Michigan Militia or the Koresh ATF tragedy, are driven by just such black and white mythic views as had crystallized in Western Illinois in the 1840s. For that reason, we desperately need to comprehend what happened there more than 150 years ago. By doing so, I'm convinced, we will be able to rethink our Nauvoo experience as it stands at our crossroad of faith and history, and hopefully reach a more deep faith and a better understanding of our past. Thanks. I'll be glad to talk to you all in terms of questions. You want to preside or?
Just for the sake of the tape, we do have several minutes now available for questions and answers, and I think the most efficient way to do that is to have Roger just stand up here and respond to you. Roger, if you'll just repeat briefly the question so the tape has it.
Okay.
You've got lots of questions.
I'm sure. Yeah. Oh, nobody calls me that. Right. Yes. Oh, okay. The question was, how did Joseph Smith III deal with some of the theological innovations, I think is really what you're saying, about that took place in Nauvoo, because he basically rejected the temple rituals. In fact, in 1893, he wrote a letter to a fellow named L.L. Barth in Idaho, in which he said, "I would not value going through the temple a dollar's worth. I can see nothing sacred or divine in it." Which I think is an interesting observation. The reason the way in which he dealt with this is basically he said, which is also the perspective that the RLDS has followed right up to the present, that temples are valid. Temples are commanded of God. When they are commanded to be built, we go build them. The temple that is to be built in any location is like the temple that was built in Kirtland. And we know what the temple in Kirtland, what they did in the temple in Kirtland. It was used for public worship on the first floor, where they held various worship services. The most important of which that we know about was the dedication service. It's used for educational purposes. The second floor was the School of the Apostles. The third floor was priesthood quorum meeting space and office space. That's how the temple is to be used. These rituals were not a part of that. And they would simply reject that as something that had been tacked on after Joseph's death. Okay, the question was, how did the shift take place from this very private teaching of polygamy that hardly anybody knew about to one where basically everybody knew about it? Okay, all right. Okay, yeah, and then who was the originator, basically, and how did it get started and why did it get started? I think there's lots of various approaches that you can take to this, but one of the things that I think is true for most of the people in Nauvoo right up through Joseph Smith's death is that they are not aware of this except in whisperings that take place at parties and people gathering around a fire to talk or something. It's probably not very well known. It's a very elect group that is incorporated into this. Now, that elect group included the leaders who went to Utah. And consequently, they were the ones who told the people that this was the thing that we should do and that Joseph taught us this. And it was believed by those folks because they had implicit belief in what Brigham Young told them. The RLDS, and this is something that's a very different thing from between the RLDS and the LDS. The church in Nauvoo essentially went to Utah. The church that was outside of Nauvoo oftentimes didn't go to Utah. Don't think that in 1844 there was just the little group of saints in Nauvoo. There was a large group of people outside in various congregations. A lot of those people, especially in the Midwest, ended up in the RLDS church. They had never been, and this is part of the reason why the RLDS spent all this time dealing with polygamy, they had never been kind of indoctrinated into these ideas. And as far as they knew, all that they knew was the public statements of Joseph Smith, what was printed in the magazines and newspapers, what they had heard talked publicly by missionaries who had come through, and those, by the way, right down the line, one after another, deny this practice. There is a statement in the Times and Seasons in, is it June or May? It's just before Joseph dies, in which he stands up and denounces the practice of plural marriage. And the RLDS have used that for a century as an indication that Joseph didn't believe it, he didn't start it, and he denounced it from the pulpit. He did. the question was, I made a statement about Joseph Smith being lynched. That terminology is not often used for a shooting. Although, if you look at the dictionary definition, it is an acceptable term. Yes. The question was there any attempts to try to resolve differences short of violence that we aren't necessarily aware of? And sure there were. There are some people who had cooler heads on both sides who tried to maintain some kind of a relationship that was more amenable than what ultimately took place. Those people were never in a position of sufficient authority to get anything to happen, either on either side. I mean, there are numerous instances of people like William Marks, who was the stake president in Nauvoo, of certain people like Ebenezer Robinson, who was also in Nauvoo, of Hamilton in Carthage, trying to mediate things. These were kind of secondary figures, however. They couldn't call shots for the larger community. And one of the things that seems to happen, and this is true in mob violence in general, is that when it starts to degenerate, it moves very, very quickly, and it's hard for somebody to control. We've all seen the westerns where the sheriff stands out on the porch when somebody wants to come in and lynch some prisoner he's got. We've all seen that, and they stare him down. That does happen perhaps on occasion, but usually, you know, they would rush past the guy and go do what they wanted anyway. It's hard for middle ground positions to be heard when extreme positions are drowning them out. And by the way, I think we're seeing that right now with the middle ground being kind of swept away in the war of words between extremes on the left and the right in the political process right now. Yeah, in the back. The question was that the RLDS and the LDS have been in denial of their history for a long period of time, but the RLDS at least recently seems to be more accommodating to revisionist ideas. I think there are some very important reasons for that, and one of them is that the RLDS are basically trying to move in a direction away from Mormonism and a distancing of ourselves from Mormonism. We, for a long period of time, actually I think it's the right place to be, by the way, for a long period of time we sat on kind of what I called a tightrope, somewhere in the middle between Mormonism and Protestantism. And a phrase that I like to use was to be legitimate to the one and at least have a touchstone with the other. And that place in the middle has now started to erode, and we are moving very rapidly in a sustained manner toward mainstream Protestantism. And as a result of that, we're no longer concerned about ensuring that the myth of our history is maintained in the way that it had been at one time. So I think that's the reason. Yes? Yeah, okay. The question was, is anybody doing work on Emma? Not to my knowledge. I think I'm pretty knowledgeable on the RLDS side about who's doing what. I don't believe there's anybody writing anything on Emma Smith. I think that the Val Avery, Linda Newell book that was done about, more than 10 years ago now, has been pretty much looked upon as kind of the final word, and it's not time yet to reinterpret that. Yeah, over here. Okay, the question was Joseph Smith persecuted religiously in the period before Nauvoo? Since I basically say I don't think persecution was the issue in Nauvoo. I can make a hesitant response, but I haven't done all the research.
Okay,
all right, okay. Okay, you had a second question? That's a good question. The question is, has anybody done any work comparing Joseph Smith and David Koresh? The answer is, I don't think so, although maybe somebody has. If anybody knows anybody that's doing stuff on that, it's an interesting comparison. I wouldn't touch it with a 10-foot pole. Yeah, right here. Okay. Yeah. The question was, what was the relationship of the Nauvoo theocratic government with the county government? Well, they were at odds for a long period of time. But the Mormons, by 1843, had the majority of the votes in the county. So they just elected either friends or members to all county offices, which essentially, according to the non-Mormons, disfranchised them. Yeah, it was a fundamental part of the problem. One of the big parts of the problem, by the way, in the period after Joseph Smith's death, was that a Jack Mormon was the sheriff. And he caused no end of problems. He was extremely obnoxious in just in a variety of ways. And he just exacerbated the tensions. Yes, over here. Oh, yeah. Okay, what was the question was, what was the ideas about the Nauvoo Legion and how that affected perceptions? It scared the living daylights out of people. Here is, everybody's got militias back in these days. I mean, it's kind of the predecessor to the National Guard. But basically, it's, 40 guys who come out once a year and march around in the hot sun and then go have a beer. That's how militias were thought of. And by the way, the regular, and they were on record on that for years. But the states wouldn't do it. But here was the Nauvoo Legion, created in the same way that all these other militias were, that had, by 1841, 1,500 men in arms. They were well armed. They were very serious about their training. They had a half a dozen cannon. And they went out and they marched around and they were very effective. This scared the living daylights out of anybody. It looked like Joseph Smith had his own private little army, which is not all that far from the truth. Yes? Okay, the question, if the Nauvoo Legion was so powerful, how come they got driven out? Well, the reason is that after Joseph's death, Brigham Young and none of the other leaders of the church were willing to commit that army to warfare. Ultimately, 1,500 men is a lot of men, but if they really started fighting the state troops, if they really went up against General John J. Hardin, who was sent in the fall of 1844 to establish order there, that would have really excited everybody, and they would have crushed them. It would have made Far West look like a picnic. Yes? Okay, the question was, what about John C. Bennett and his practicing of free love? Well, he did it. Yeah, the guy was pretty licentious, I think. But he had the cover of these other activities that were taking place, and we know about this. Joseph Smith, the record is fairly clear. He was marrying extra wives at least by 1841. Brigham was in England. Bennett was right there, member of the First Presidency, involved in the practice as well. And, so he was using that as a cover, I think. Somebody else back in the back. Yes, sir. Okay, the question was, how do the Gentiles that are in Hancock County today, how do they like the Mormons? Well, not very well, I think. I don't know what your experience was. And as a Mormon missionary, I suspect you probably got a couple of extremes in terms of responses. Let me tell you, there was a guy named Elmer Krause in Nauvoo, just a minute, who had been there for years and years and years. He was one of the old German immigrant families who'd come in the 1850s. And he owned like half of the town. The other half the Mormons owned. And Elmer Krause ran the cafe, the Five and Dime, the Hotel Utah, the Hotel Nauvoo, and several of the other major businesses, the dry cleaners, the laundromat, all that stuff belonged to Elmer Krause. And he, whenever there was a piece of property that was a part of the historic district that came up for sale, some little old lady was going to die or something and she wanted to sell it, he would run down and buy it to keep the Mormons from getting it, because he knew that it was something that Nauvoo Restoration Incorporated wanted. And there was a confrontation about something like 10 years ago now between him and some of the folks that were working for Nauvoo Restoration. And Elmer Krause and the fellow who was working in Nauvoo Restoration, this story was told to me by Elmer. He was threatened by the Nauvoo Restoration guy saying, look, it's just a matter of time. We're going to be here indefinitely and you're going to be dead in a few years. And we're going to get all this stuff. And he says, there is no way on earth you are ever going to get this. I'm going to put it in an indisputable trust. Now, if that's any indication of the feelings that are present there, I think that there's still a fair amount of anti-Mormon sentiment. And when other things exacerbate that, like the destruction of the Icarian schoolhouse on the temple lot in 1962, a historic site in its own right, and just demolished literally in the dead of night by a bunch of bulldozers by Nauvoo Restoration, that just excites the ire of people. Okay, I'm sorry. Yes, sir.
My family and I went to Nauvoo.
I have to make a response to that. That's the that's a Joseph Smith basic approach as well. In 1843, he put a bar in the Mansion House, and you're not supposed to drink, right? Emma at the time was in St. Louis buying furniture and things. When she arrived, she went through the ceiling. That he had done this, and Orrin Porter Rockwell was standing behind the counter at that point, polishing glasses. And Joseph's comment was, "Well, Gentiles have to have some place to drink. we might as well take their money. I mean, they're going to spend it anyway. We might as well take it." Which is also the same kind of rationale for casino gambling and a variety of other sin type things. In the back, yes. Oh, I'm sorry. He made a comment about. Going to Nauvoo and asking the question about relations between the Mormons and the Gentiles, and the fellow running the cash register opened it up and pulled out $2 bills and said, they both spend the same, basically, and we don't care. All right, in the back, Carl. He was absolutely, the question was, what was the reaction of William Marks? And his response was one of tremendous fear. I mean, this terrified him. He was actually scared in the Far West. And in 1839, when they had the conference of the church to decide upon the settlement in Nauvoo, he stood up and said, this is not a very good idea to gather together again. Remember what happened to us in Missouri. Every time we get together as a group, we have these problems. But he went along with it because that was the will of the majority. And he became the stake president, and he tried to mediate certain things, but he was very concerned. And when he learned about, he didn't learn about, I don't think, plural marriage until August of 1843, when Hiram Smith came into the High Council and read the Revelation. And after that time, he was dead set against it. And he's on record in the late 1840s and 1850s about meetings with Joseph after the fact, saying, this is really a bad thing. And Joseph presumably telling him, well, you're right, it is. There's one statement that's famous in RLDS literature where Joseph Smith supposedly tells William Marks, I thought polygamy would prove a blessing, and I find it proves a curse. We've got to stop this. I'm going to go into the High Council and preach that we've got to stop it. And if people don't stop, I'm going to bring charges against them and cut them off. And so I think he was very much concerned about that. And things were spinning out of control. He couldn't control them. But he was a true believer. I mean, he became a member of the first presidency of the RLDS Church later on. Over here, yeah. Yeah, it really is.
Repeat the question and relate it to the Nauvoo controversy.
Oh! The question was what's the status of the RLDS Church and the splits that have taken place. I think most of you are probably aware that in 1984 there was a revelation brought forward in the RLDS community to ordain women. It also directed the building of a temple and a variety of other things. It's now 10 plus years down the fact. Women have been ordained. They serve in various capacities in the priesthood. They are appointee ministers, full-time ministers for the church in some cases. They are pastors of congregations. And that has created some contention. And a number of people who were essentially of a very traditional mind could not agree with that and left the church. Most of them never removed their names from the rolls. Most of them are still carried on the rolls. But it did hurt the membership, and certainly it hurt the income of the church, because they were some of the most diligent givers in terms of tithing. In terms of numbers, it's hard to say. I've heard numbers everywhere from 500 people to 30,000 who have left the church in one form or another. And when I say left the church, not formally removed their names, are no longer worshiping in RLDS congregations today. About 250,000. The 30,000 number is probably closer to true than the 500 number. Well, I know it is. Some of them have formed independent branches. They have taken a measure from the RLDS's history, which after the death of Joseph Smith and the movement of the majority of the Utah, or the majority of the Nauvoo Saints to Utah, a lot of congregations, we have a very strong congregational tendency in the RLDS Church, that a lot of these independent, or a lot of congregations that were in the Midwest, in places that you've never heard of, in Wisconsin and Illinois and Iowa, basically met as independent congregations for some cases as much as a decade. And that's what they've done. They've kind of returned to that model with the intention that some future date there will either be a cleansing in the RLDS Church or the emergence of a new reorganization. And I've got to tell you, does everybody know Bill Russell or know who he is? Okay. Well, Bill Russell is kind of the resident RLDS guy who likes to jab the knife and twist it in the back of the RLDS presidency. He's kind of the RLDS Paul Toscano. Anyway, maybe the similarity ends there. Bill is writing a book about the fundamentalist schism, which should be out next year. And after a member of the First Presidency, a fellow by the name of Alan Tyree, gave an interview to the Kansas City newspaper, he said, Alan Tyree, member of the First Presidency, said that only 500 people had left the church because of these controversies. And, of course, what Tyree was doing was counting the numbers that had officially had asked their names to be removed from the rolls. Well, there's a branch in a place called Buckner, Missouri, that's about 20 miles outside of Independence, which has kind of been a hotbed of the conservative movement there. Not long after that article appeared, Bill went to the church service, and there were 500 people in the audience. So he dropped a note to Alan, in which he said, "Alan, just wanted you to know, last weekend I was at the Buckner congregation, and that all 500 of the people who left the church were there." So,
Roger, we've got time for one more question.
One more question. Okay, so, somebody who hasn't talked. It's growing like... The question was, my father is one of the dissidents, by the way. He is the presiding bishop of the Restoration Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints. I have brochures if you're interested. He is the presiding bishop. It has a First Presidency. My brother's a member of the First Presidency. And the president of the church, the prophet of the church, is a fellow by the name of Marcus Juby, who is a Lamanite. And who is considered by the membership the one mighty and strong. And my father, at the last general assembly of this organization, was set apart as a lineal descendant of Aaron. But it is growing. He has something in the neighbor. They have something in the neighborhood of 20,000 members now. Some do and some don't. My dad had his name removed. I don't think my mother did. Okay, I think on that note we have to quit. It's been fun. If you want to talk some more, we can do that afterwards.
Thank you, Roger, and thank you all for attending.